Morning, I'm a very much respected. Thank you very much, Chairperson, Deputy Minister of Health, Dr. Dupasa, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for this opportunity. I was asked to come and make two presentations here, one on Zika virus infection, because there was a lot of concern that perhaps something is happening which the public doesn't know about. The second presentation is about typhoid fever. There was a belief that we have got a big outbreak of typhoid fever here. And I just want to identify issues and make a presentation about that. The first starting with Zika virus, as we have heard, this is a mosquito transmitted virus. It was first unveiled in a forest in Uganda called the Zika Forest. That's where it should be came from. I'm sure members of the committee are becoming used to the fact that whenever there are viruses, they are named other places. And sometimes people get confused where this thing comes from. Like Ebola virus was first discovered at Ebola River in the DRC. So the same thing with the Zika virus. The name is derived from the Zika Forest in Uganda in 1947. It is transmitted to humans through mosquito vector, which is called Aedes, especially Aedes aegypti. That mosquito also transmits three other diseases, the dengue fever, the yellow fever, and chikungunya virus. I'm sure many of you are aware that whenever you fly out of the country, sometimes you demand the yellow fever certificate. See if you have been vaccinated, because we do have a vaccine against yellow fever. Unfortunately, we don't have any against Zika virus yet, even though they are transmitted by the same mosquito. Now, one of the things that we really want members of the committee to know, and the public to understand, Zika virus infection is a self-limiting disease. We don't know anybody yet around the world since 1947 as far as we are concerned, unless maybe I might have missed the information, but as far as we are concerned, we don't know anybody who died of Zika virus. It always produces self-limiting symptoms with an acute onset of fever. That means the temperature goes high, they get some rash on the skin, they get joint and muscle pain, they got conjunctivitis, that means some red eyes, and they get headache. These, as I said, are self-limiting symptoms. But the biggest problem why it's causing headache is because it's associated with a condition called microcephaly and other neurological conditions. And cephalon is a Latin word for brain. Micro, as you know, is small. So it means babies are born with small brains and small heads. And that is a link that scientists are trying to find directly. In other words, there's not yet been a very direct link. It's just by association, meaning that in areas where this Zika virus is very prevalent, they found kids with this condition. And the conclusion is that there is an association between this condition and Zika virus. So that's our biggest fear, meaning the most people who are in biggest danger of this virus are pregnant men, not ordinary other people, because of its self-limiting nature. I just want to emphasize that. Up so far, we have got no evidence of human-to-human transmission, except the two sexually transmitted cases that were reported in the U.S. That was very new in the history of Zika, but believe that there might have been transmission, sexual transmission in this school, again based on some circumstantial evidence. But the main issue is that no human being can transmit the virus to another human being without the presence of mosquito in between. That's what we mean by a vector. That this disease, to move from one human being to the other, it has to be conveyed by that mosquito. You can't transmit it directly. If that's not possible, you need that mosquito to do that. So there's international concern, of course, about the virus, because as of the 6th February 2016, over 34 countries have been affected, and most of them are in South America. That's why people are so worried about South America, but there are other countries outside South America, and as of February, 34 countries already affected. Now, the other thing that might worry people is that on the 1st of February, the World Health Organization declared Zika virus outbreak in Brazil and South American countries as a public health emergency of international concern, what is usually referred as PHIIC or fake, meaning we are concerned internationally, there's an emergency in our hands. It does not necessarily mean it's scary. It simply means we need to watch out. We must watch out, of course, because it's definitely scary that we are going to start having babies with that with small head, because that condition is not reversible. Once you have got a baby born like that, it's irreversible. There can never be any form of treatment whatsoever. So WHO calls on countries to put place mechanisms for detection, prevention, and response. I've already said this about the concern to South Africa, that our real key concern will be pregnant women, especially if they travel to affected countries. I'm sure you are aware, I was watching news this morning. The Director General of the World Organization, Dr. Margaret Chan, was just saying we need to do everything in our power to discourage pregnant women from traveling to those areas, because some whispers were saying, no, if they're really forced to travel, they must speak to their gynae, they must go to their doctor to talk, but she's saying it would be much better that they just don't travel at all to these particular affected areas. Because there's no vaccine and there's no treatment. I'm saying this about Dr. Margaret Chan because on our second bullet point there, say in South Africa, we recommend that all pregnant women consider postponing travel to areas where Zika virus transmission is ongoing. We just don't think there might be any life-threatening reason that for system to travel for the sake of the baby, if even not so. My third bullet point there was that if pregnant women have to travel to Zika virus countries, they must strictly follow steps to avoid mosquito. I'm repeating, Dr. Margaret Chan this morning was saying, please let them not travel. And I think perhaps that is the safest advice we can ever get. Yeah, well, the map is just showing countries, territories, and areas with what they call autochthonous Zika virus circulation, meaning the internal one, which, as you know, we don't have in South Africa. The only change that maybe might have caused panic in South Africa is that there was a Colombian visitor on the 20th of February 2016 who came here on business, and 5 days after his arrival, he felt the symptoms I mentioned, fever, joint pains, etc., went to see a doctor who took blood and sent to Lancet Laboratories. And on the 16th of, on the 20th, they made that diagnosis for Zika with PCR, which means polymerase chain reaction, PCR assay, and of course the NICD, the National Institute of Communicable Diseases, being a custodian of all communicable diseases in our country, did confirm that diagnosis. And this man from Colombia recovered. Within a period of about 3 days, as you say, Zika takes about between 3 and 6 days. And after three days, he was fully recovered, and there was no problem. Now, the fear was, is this man going to transmit? Could there have been a chance that this man
could have transmitted the Zika virus. I'm sure some people are saying maybe they're still waiting, that it will still emerge. We think that chance to us is almost non-existent as far as we are concerned. We know that a lot of fun things do happen in nature, but also in medicine. But here we are just following logic. For the simple reason that for this man from Colombia to have left the virus circulating in South Africa, the first thing he needs is a particular subspecies of Aedes aegypti mosquito. Which that particular strain of Aedes aegypti mosquito we do not have. That is the same one that is circulating dengue fever, yellow fever, and chikungunya. You know, all those three diseases, we don't have them in South Africa. We only ask you to vaccinate for yellow fever when you go to yellow fever country. We don't have. And that's why we are able to make a scientific conclusion that we do not have the virus, I mean the mosquito that circulates those. And for that reason, we don't think we have got a mosquito that is capable of circulating the Zika virus. Yes, yes, yes. We do have our own problems of mosquitoes. And our biggest problem with mosquito is still malaria, as you know. Yes, but malaria is transmitted by the Anopheles mosquito, especially Anopheles nestus, the female, what do you call it, the female Anopheles, not the male. Male Anopheles mosquitoes are vegetarians. It's only the females that need blood. So, that's the one that transmits malaria. They need blood, of course, it's not because females are carnivorous, because they need that blood to lay eggs. Males don't lay eggs, so they don't need anybody's blood. That's why they are vegetarian. I'm emphasizing this because that's what we need to worry about. Sometimes, you know, the reason that I'm emphasizing this question is going to divert, to make a diversion here. You might remember that the director of NICD, National Institute of Communicable Diseases, Dr. Professor Shabir Mali, was once and gave the same warning on TV when Ebola struck, when everybody was painting, running, helter skelter. He said, please, you have got a problem in South Africa of TB. You are dying of TB. But none of you seem to be worried about that. You are worried about Ebola somewhere, which is unlikely to come. He said, please, if you really want to worry, worry about TB. I still remember how he was attacked, left, right, and center. But 12 months later, nobody died of Ebola. Not a single person in South Africa. But 40,000 people died of TB. I am repeating the same thing. I'm not saying we shouldn't take precautions, but I'm saying we've got our own mosquito here that is causing problems with malaria. Even though we have reduced the incidence by 89%, that's the biggest problem of Africa, South Africa, and that's our biggest worry. This feature here is not giving me sleepless nights. What is still giving me sleepless nights? It's malaria, because we are still seeing lots of people. In fact, during that Ebola epidemic, most of the people that were citing the media that they are ready to be having Ebola, all of them, or 90% of them, were actually found to be having malaria. All the tests we did at NICD, where we were affecting Ebola, they came out being malaria. That's why I'm saying that's our biggest problem. We have earned a lot, not aware that the president received a prize at AU for us to reach our Millennium Development target on malaria. We have reached that. But I'm saying it's still not gone. We'll be heavy the day there's no more malaria in South Africa. But the thing is, and we have formed what we call E8, or Elimination 8. It's 8 countries within SADC who believe if we work together very hard, by 2020, we might have eliminated malaria. That's why we call ourselves E8. That's our biggest worry. That's our biggest headache. And I'm mentioning because I still want members of this committee to put a lot of emphasis on that one. Because that's the one that really is still a killer in South Africa. The Zika virus, we really believe there are no mechanism of spreading it in the country. I was still trying to tell you what would have happened to this Colombian man to spread the disease. Firstly, he would have needed that Aedes aegypti. Secondly, it should have beaten him within that period of 7 days. That means it's a very short period. It's a period in which we see the viremia, where the virus is circulating in one's blood. It's only about 10 days or a week. That is the time at which the mosquito must bite him, not before that or not later. And then after biting him, it must then find the South African and buy that South African. And the cycle continues that way. So you can realize it's really quite a likely cycle. Firstly, because we can assure you we've never come across a mosquito that can transmit Zika. Secondly, during that period of 7 days, sitting in the middle of Johannesburg there, that just tells me the likelihood. And then from there, find the South African room at the beach. So it's something that is quite unlikely. But since 1947, Zika virus has not been identified further than the south of Uganda, in the African continent. Since the first time we came across Zika in the Zika virus in 1947, there was no stage during all that period. 1947 is how many years? 69 years. During that whole period of 69 years, no Zika virus was ever identified south of Uganda. That's why we are saying there was secondary spread of Zika virus into South Africa on account of this case from Colombia. To us, it's quite unlikely. As you know, it's more than a month now. We haven't yet had anything. So we can simply say we're right in our assumption. However, if the media statements inform people, and sometimes when we inform people, they usually say we just don't want them to pay me by hiding something, want to confirm one. That there was absolutely nothing to hide. But we did call an emergency meeting on the 22nd of February in the chief directorate dealing with communicable disease, where we need to enhance early detection prevention and emphasize on prevention. But what we did was also to coordinate the teams that are put there, like the national response teams, the provincial response teams, the National Operations Center or NATO, the Emergency Operations Center, all these were teams and preparations for Ebola. We did not disband them. So when this issue of Zika came about, regardless of what I said, but we just said we needed to get combat ready, and we reactivated all those teams. And they are still there. We enhanced surveillance at port of entry, at our port of entry at the airport. Health facility, we issued guidelines for case definition and laboratory testing protocol, etc., etc. That means we did everything that I presented to this committee about our readiness for Ebola. We just said, please get ready, and they are ready at the present moment. And of course, as you know, the NICD did some briefings. We also put some information on the website. We're also doing vector control at airports because we are using WHO standards. In other words, when a plane leaves all those affected countries, that plane is spread. I mean, it's sprayed with some disinfectant there to make sure that no mosquito can leave. In other words, we believe the only way the situation can change in South Africa, if I may explain that, if by any chance a mosquito is imported into South Africa from those areas, we think that's another, it's one of the main risks in which you could ever get Zika. If that type of mosquito that is able to enter the vector is imported, as you know, mosquitoes are unlikely to cross the Atlantic on their own. The only way they can do it is through a plane, is to be transported by us, especially in the plane. So all the plane from there is a spray that is recommended by the WHO. Many of you have been in the plane, you have seen the cabin attendants moving with that frame to the back of the plane and back, is to make sure that there's no chance of any mosquito escaping to those areas and coming to us. We are trying to do the same even with the cargo at the ships. Cargo that are brought by ship from those particular areas. We're also doing environmental studies to learn about the Aedes aegypti mosquito. We are reviewing the pathogenicity of the virus in humans. The reason that we have reviewed this pathogenicity to make sure that when we say this is self-limiting, we actually mean it. But also to review the review of diagnosis and treatment of cases, including pregnant women. That's the work that NICD is doing. Thank you, Chairperson. Let me pause there.
Thank you. James, much, and thank you to Minister Moshulady for the presentation. So one of the really important things about this engagement has to do with the fact that there has to be continual trust placed in government when it comes to health messages. And therefore, what happened here and elsewhere is most welcome, and I thank you very much for that. And we know that one of the reasons why a lot of the special operations in West Africa is that the president simply didn't believe their government when it came to health messages. And clearly we have a level of public trust, and but it does continue to consolidate that public trust that comes to dealing with this virus. Also, listening to all the measures that have been taken, I'm very pleased that this has been done, and not surprised given your energy levels. So thank you very much. I have one small question, and that has to do with the second-hand tire market globally. You know that these mosquitoes breed inside of flower pots, and particularly inside of tires. And the second-hand global tire market is a big one and a big part of the story. So when you look at that as another factor when it comes to the inspection of ships, for example.
Pregnant women.
Should it be, in other words, not going unless it's essential travel or control of funding, because it's slightly different, and it's important to make the message not clear. And the other thing, this would be, I guess, a difficult question to answer, and I'll ask it anyway. Looking at past outbreaks, cycles of outbreaks, is there any idea of how long these travel restrictions will continue? Any sense of, do these outbreaks that we die out, or outbreaks die out after a certain period, or will it be an event?
Minister, what I'd like to know is this.
your engagement with home affairs in ensuring that you implement restrictions in terms of the border control and airports and things like that to ensure that those that are coming in or going out that are raised in particular and might be in contact with members from those different countries that are affected and coming back into those processes to follow, monitor, develop to ensure that, you know, we one or two of them don't skip the process that we may have already in place. Especially if some members may be from a country, visited those countries with that. I'm not sure how long this could remain if you undetected. If I tell someone that is continuous on IHF, that it could remain in human body undetected for a period of time and then they go back to the country and come in. So that's the question you answer that could be. Minister, has there ever been any case in South Africa of children born with smaller brains or smaller heads? And the reason why I'm asking is because I know you will make clear that South Africa does not have the specific material that can transmit this. I want to tell you on that so that we would see in terms of that, if you have a anyone who has it, we can check on them to see whether perhaps there was any new issue that was happening. The one that actually was confirmed as a Zika victim in South Africa from Colombia, have we ever done any research into the activities and the people close to them? Again, of course, I know the issue of the fact that we don't have a mosquito, you say that the mosquito itself is but I think also the problem of secondary transmission, so I don't have much clarity on that one.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Wilbur James here, she spoke about the second-hand tire market. Because, yes, as you know, mosquitoes lay their eggs in areas that can accumulate and keep basic water, you know, water that's not moving, like tires, some hollows, trees, tins, you know, empty tins, which accumulate water, etc. Coincidentally, the last time South Africa got a deadly fever virus was in 1929, and it was brought in by second-hand tires. But since 1929, it never happened. So we will watch out for that, for any consignment of tires, because even though it happened some 8 years, more than 8 years ago, but it did happen, and since that time, it never. That's why we, up to now, don't have deadly fever. But the second-hand tire did bring it up at that time, so it's not an impossibility. It's just improbable because it happened once in 8 years. I mean, it happened once in 8 years, but we also watch it for such type of things. The incident rate of Zika, I don't really have an answer about that. I don't remember coming across the issues of incidents, meaning in terms of incidence, I'm sure you are aware, is different from prevalence, because prevalence means the number of people infected in the population. Incidence means the number of new infections. I didn't really come across that information. I think because this is a very new virus, the world authorities are still waiting on that. The issue of malaria, maybe you also answer the question from Honorable Masalera. The issue of malaria, Bakashiwana, between us, let me just explain. Malaria is not a problem in the whole of the country. It's a problem in 4 districts out of 52. As Honorable Masalera said, it's Vembe district in Limpopo, it's Mopani district in Limpopo, it's Itanzeni district in Mpumalanga, and it's Mhanyakunje in KwaZulu-Natal. Those are the 4 districts that are endemic of malaria. And all our plans is about those 4 districts. Actually, we have to spray, literally. As you know, our control of malaria is through what we call indoor residual spray, IRS, where we spray the inside of the houses with DDT, a chemical called DDT. That is the mainstay of control of malaria in South Africa. Every year, around those borders I've mentioned, we have got spray 80% of the households twice a year. That is every 6 months. If we stop doing that, or we make a mistake in doing that, or we do less than 80% of the houses, you can actually see the incidence of malaria going up. You know, there was one in 2011, 7 heads of state, including President Zuma, were given prizes by the African Union and the Secretary General of the World Organization for the work of control on malaria. We had the South African journalist there in AU in Ethiopia when the president received that prize, and she was asking me very hard questions about the rest of the healthcare system, and I said, but why are you ignoring this issue of malaria? We also got a prize here, you must also report the positive things. She said, no, that one is not, malaria is not a problem, you have got it under control. I said, it's not a problem because we have got to do this every day for the rest of our lives until it's gone. And if you go to sleep, it will come back. So don't take it for granted. In other words, she was saying, I'm not going to report on it because you've already won that battle. And I'm trying to show that the battle is not won until everything is gone. As you are sitting here in Parliament not knowing, there are workers there in overalls and all that who every day are waking up to get into their houses and spray. That is why SADC has got what we call Malaria Day in October, where we choose one of the SADC countries. We go there for a SADC meeting. At the end of it, we celebrate what we call Malaria Day. We choose a village where all the ministers will start together to go and spray that in that village, just to symbolically show that the spray must go on. So that's what we are doing. Now, it's true, Dr. Kajwan, that we did have a problem with Mozambique. You can't fight malaria alone. So we do corridors. There was what we call Trans-Libombo Corridor between Swaziland, Mozambique, and South Africa. It was one of the best cooperative agreements until, unfortunately, not a big run out of money, there were problems. But the deputy minister took up the issue with the minister of Mozambique. They had quite a number of several meetings. We brought it back on board. We have got another one called Mozisa, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and South Africa, where we are working with the three countries. We work in groups. Now we have got this E8, which I've just mentioned. But at the moment, yes, the only malaria we get in South Africa is that which is imported from our neighboring countries. Now, Honorable Matala was saying, how do we check the borders? I think with every disease, Honorable Members, you can do almost everything you want to do, but the question is it really necessary? Can we follow up people and check each one of them crossing the border whether they've got malaria? That would be next to impossible task. So we are concentrating rather on the mosquito, on this one rather than in the individual. It's not like Ebola. I want you to understand the difference. The reason that with Ebola, we concentrate on the human being is because the human being has spread it on their own, human to human contact. Now this one, because there's an animal in between, a vector, we concentrate on that vector and we leave the human being. Because we can't pay special attention to human beings, I can tell you it will be a very difficult, extraordinarily expensive task, and it won't bring many good returns. That's what I want to say. So we are not really bothered. We have never checked anybody except checking the temperatures at airport. We have never bothered about people crossing over with that, as long as we are able to check the mosquito, you know. And in those districts I'm talking about, people know, I once worked in one of these endemic areas in Bushbuck Ridge. It was standard that anybody who comes with fever, you do malaria smear. So it was very, even junior people could treat malaria there. One of the most dangerous places to be if you catch malaria is to be in Johannesburg or Durban or Cape Town. The doctor there knows very little about malaria. They hardly ever see it. They could easily need it. So if you want to be safe, you must be in those rural areas, because there, even a junior nurse can recognize malaria when they see it, because it's endemic, but it's only in those areas. Remember that malaria needs very hot, humid areas. They don't need cold areas. That's why a country like Lesotho has got no malaria at all. When we meet about malaria in Southern Lesotho, it's just sitting there drizzling. They'll never get it. With all that snow and high, low temperatures there, it won't. So in the district that are affected, you can realize the high temperatures at the same time. Dr. Boning, you say, what is the actual message? Look, our message must go in depth. Pregnant women, yes. First eyes, body cover. That's our first eyes. But you know, you are dealing with human beings. There are other very serious issues other than medical. Human beings are not just biological entities. There are also social entities. There are economic entities. There are many other. There are religious entities. There are cultural entities. In other words, all those things, religious factors, cultural factors, economic factors, social factors, go guide human beings. Because of that, we can't put a ban. There is no ban we are putting. We are just saying our first price, don't travel. That's our first price. If all those other factors are overwhelming, that maybe we should sit with your doctor who can advise you. Advise you on what? Like we have put an Olympic team going there. We're not stopping them. But we wouldn't like a pregnant woman in that Olympic team. But even with that Olympic team, we wrote to the Minister of Sport that if you are really forced to go there, like Olympians are forced, make sure that you avoid being beaten by mosquito. Yes, make sure. How do you do that? Make sure that you live with mosquito repellent. Your whole body, you must use mosquito repellent. They are sold in local shops here all over. Make sure that you wear long sleeves. Make sure that if you find yourself in a house, inside the room, that room, whether in a hotel or what, that room has got air condition going on. If you don't have an air condition, sleep next to a fan. No mosquito can ever fly across a fan. That air is very strong, you know. It will just be blown away. Just put the fan next to you and sleep there, and you know that every mosquito approaching you will be blown away. Those are the advices that we are giving people. And coincidentally, it was found that the Aedes aegypti, unlike the Anopheles mosquito, is very active during the day. The Anopheles is usually active during the night. This one is an active mosquito during the day. So we are just saying watch out during the day when you are there. That's all we can say. But if you are pregnant, really, it has to be a matter of life and death for you to travel. Please avoid it. I think maybe It will be easier, Dr. Bolmiga, and I said, to give one clear message. If I have to choose one clear message, it's on travel. But I've just explained that we are dealing with human beings here. We have got many other factors. So our first prize, on travel. If we really have to take all the precautions, make sure that no mosquito comes nearer to you or bites you, then that's the only guarantee. The issue of how long will there be a travel restrictions, we really don't know. What we are thinking is this, honorable member. You know, we think the world has entered a new era, which we really have to watch about. That's why we have even asked the World Organization in the Africa region to change their strategy and budgeting methods. Their strategy and budgeting were vertical. Put aside money for a polio program, put aside money for HIV/AIDS program, put aside money for malaria program. That's how the World Health Organization works in the Africa region. In 2014, we asked them to change that and change it to what? We said, please strengthen the healthcare system. Make every healthcare system so strong that anything that comes, we can deal with it. What we did that was, it looks like here we might find ourselves chasing a wild goose. Firstly, it was HIV. In Africa, we set up all systems to fight HIV all over Africa. PEPFAR gave a lot of money. Every single time we put up systems to fight HIV, just as we thought we were winning, Ebola came. We now start from the first. Hey, how to fight Ebola? We did that, we did that. Hardly 2 years after Ebola is Zika. We are now running around and we don't know what might come tomorrow. Yes. They're just following one another. We have entered that new era. And we think that pattern may continue for three main reasons. That pattern might not be able to stop. That's why we said the main thing, go to the health system, strengthen it, make it ready for anything. What are the three things? Number one, there is climate change. We honestly don't know what this climate change is bringing. It's changing temperatures and bringing in conditions that never existed for centuries. And they are bringing new things that human beings are not used to. That is the first problem. The second problem, because of growing populations, human beings are starting to encroach on nature. In other ways, we are touching corners, which we are not supposed to be touching. In fact, for food and habitat, because we are growing. Take, for instance, the issue of Ebola. If we did not tamper with birds and wild animals looking for food, we wouldn't even have known that there's Ebola. You know, because if you remember the first case at the Ebola River, the first case of this Ebola was a teacher who bought the monkey to go and sell it for food. That's how this whole thing started. He was looking for food and he caught a monkey. And then he unveiled something that was not there. And then in West Africa, they are chasing birds for food, you know, birds for food and all that. So that system of looking for food and encroaching on natural habitat is continuing around the world. They say a belief. It has not yet caught fire, but there is a belief that the resurgence of Zika in South America is because they are cutting down the Amazon forest, you know, looking for firewood log, but also for agricultural purposes and all that. There is that belief that that's how. So we believe the issue of humanity and crunch, and it's not going to stop because we are growing. That goes also with globalization. In the past, a disease will be in one area, die down on its own. But this is spread like wildfire because we are almost one village in the whole world. Within seconds, a person will have moved from one area to the other. So that encroachment together with globalization, we think, is the second reason. The third reason, we are also entering a very dangerous era, but the World Organization is dealing with it. The antibiotic era. We have got antibiotics now, which have been there for centuries to kill microorganisms. Many of them are starting to be resistant. There's something called antimicrobial resistance. We are even forming teams in every country, even at the World Organization, whereby an ordinary organism, which for centuries we've been able to treat with antibiotics, is just refusing to die. It's resistant. In other words, just says, no, I'm no longer going to be killed by this medicine of yours. You know? And it's scary, because now what it means is you'll have a person who is not sick going for an ordinary knee replacement surgery, have you booked in some months back, go in, get a small infection there, we are suddenly unable to treat that person. because there is antimicrobial resistance. All of antimicrobial resistance also is activities of human beings. For instance, the activities of doctors and the patients. Doctor, you know, where, as a doctor, you know how many times patients force you to prescribe antibiotics for them when they've got flu. They insist, and doctors, to satisfy their patients, they give antibiotics, they spread all over. Now there is resistance, which is killing all of us. So it's activities, we want to find a way to control doctors, not to give antibiotics at random. Most of them, if you meet them, they'll tell you that, I know I shouldn't be doing it, but my patients are insisting. Especially doctors in private practice who depends on goodwill of patients coming. Inside the hospital, you might refuse. Then they'll hit that hospital and say, no, it's a poor hospital. Then it will arise in the media that people are angry. They don't get medicines in that particular hospital. When the doctors are trying to save the nation and say, no, you've got an ordinary flu. Just take a cough mixture and another will be better. No antibiotics. Patient in. Now, those who are in private practice, they are almost held at ransom. Because doctors believe if I refuse the wish of this patient, will the patient come back tomorrow? I'm going to starve. So let me give the wish of the patient, even though I know medically it's nonsense. And so that's how the world gets affected. The other one is animal husbandry. In countries like Holland, they've already banned the use of antibiotics, in routine antibiotics in animal husbandry, where antibiotics are given to animals in where, you know, the by a lot of farmers. You are sitting here believing I'm not taking any antibiotics, but you are taking milk and food from those animals which are routinely fed antibiotics. One day you get sick, we give you the antibiotics, nothing work on you, it refuses, and we've got no other antibiotics to use. So that's antimicrobial resistance. If you look at all these activities, they are brought about by natural disasters, human beings. Because even climate change itself, the way human beings interacted with the planet, the issue of encouragement, as I said, just cutting forests, looking for wild animals, is also human activity. Antimicrobial resistance is also human activity. All those activities, we don't know what will bring tomorrow. So we must sit in waiting. So we can't tell how long will we have restriction. We can't tell what will come tomorrow. The best thing to do, strengthen the healthcare system, get ready for whatever comes. We don't know what's coming. I don't want to threaten you, please. And don't write headlines that are really colorful there, please. I'm scared people will say the minister says catastrophe is coming. I'm not saying so. I'm just saying as we sit here because of the same situations, we don't know what's coming tomorrow on this planet. And so please don't scare people away, because I don't know which planet they will rush to if you scare them. The issue of communication, Honorable James, yes. I think, honorable members, please, let's understand that communication must also be an art, you know. If you just communicate something because you want people to know, when there is not much activity around that, they might get confused. Let me find a very good way to put it. I'm saying communication must be in line with an activity that's happening for the population to understand it. Like in South America, communication about Jesus must be every second, in every form of media, in churches, in schools, and all that. If you start doing the same in South Africa, all you sort of confuse the population and scare them. Yes, in South America, they must do that. No kid must go to school without being told about these mosquitoes. Nobody must go to church. No people must not go to big gatherings without being informed. The radio must never keep quiet. The TV must not keep quiet. The print media must not keep quiet. But if you bring that type of intense activity in South Africa, I'm sure you'll scare people and confuse them, because they'll see, but what's happening? Are we about to die or what? So when we communicate, we check. You know, like around this Colombian man, we heightened communication. Please remember, I went to the radios, I went to the TV, I tried to cover all the African language radio stations which are listened to by rural people, because the other radio stations were chasing already, and the English medium radio stations, for instance, were already chasing, on the chase, because they wanted information. The other smaller radio stations and community radio stations, I was inviting myself. But once that issue died off, we also keep it off, because if we heighten it, as if there is imminent danger, it will also confuse people. So that's how we are carrying on in communication. The issue of monitoring travel, I'm sure I've already... Honorable Sheikh, I've already dealt with it. whether microcephaly is new in South Africa, absolutely not. Not even in the world. We do have children here with microcephaly, but it's not caused by Zika. It has always been there, caused by other, it's a neurological condition, caused by other, made by other causes. When I was still a medical student, one of the biggest causes in pregnant women was a cytomegalovirus. So there's a virus called cytomegalo, which used to fascinate us. Cytomegalovirus causes microcephaly, because micro means small, cephaly means brain, small brain, but it's caused by a virus called cytomegalo. Cyto means cell, cell, megalo means big, mega. So it's a virus with a big cell but causing a small head. That used to be the one that was concerning us among pregnant women. But because of various antenatal care, it seems to have disappeared. So don't think microcephaly is a new thing to the world. It's definitely not. It can happen any time. The reason that they are associating it with Zika in South America is immediately on the advent of Zika, microcephaly just ran like hellfire beyond what they used to see. In other words, they used to see children with microcephaly, for instance, as mentioned, but immediately when Zika came in, it just moved like hellfire, where in Brazil alone there were about 4,000 cases of microcephaly. That's very abnormal. And they looked around, what is the new entrant to the scene? And they found that is Zika virus. And that's why I say they are linking them. For now, this must be caused by the Zika virus. Because before it was there, we ordinarily had microcephaly not moving at this rate. Whether we checked people next to the Colombians, no, we didn't. For the reasons I've already mentioned. That Colombian was no danger to anybody. Whoever interacted with, he couldn't have given them the Zika virus. Because I told you, no matter whether they sit together and eat together and all that, they still didn't need that mosquito between them. So there was no point in chasing people who have been with Colombia. I think, Rema Salela, I think I've responded to all your questions about malaria and borders communication and special focus on cause of entry. Our special focus on cause of entry is also not on human beings on this one. We are still continuing our focus on human beings as far as Ebola is concerned, even though we are still taking temperatures. But our focus here on port of entry is the possibility of a transported mosquito. That's why we check the goods, we check the ship, we make sure that even before the plane leaves that country, if it comes to South Africa, it must have been sprayed with an insecticide. Sorry. Thank you, Chairperson.
This explanation, because human beings are carriers of malaria, mosquitoes cannot transmit malaria if they do not bite the carrier and take the parasite and transmit them to the other person. And we know that countries like Mozambique are endemic malaria areas, and they come to South Africa, and I don't think we simulate their transport when they come in, and the mosquitoes, they come with them in their vehicles and the buses and buy somebody into medicine, and maybe a few people were in the United States, and because if you keep on fighting somebody who's called Jose Carrier and fight somebody else, what are we doing to minimize this type of danger? We don't talk about putting them in quarantine or test them for the virus, the person before they can get to insure and things like that. And that's the reason. I think the places you mentioned are different from Mozambique. So people may be able to
Honorable Member, let me be very careful because some of these issues can be confusing. Malaria is endemic in all other countries except Lesotho. Every other country has got malaria. but in varying amounts. It's only the soto that doesn't have. And I've given you the reading. So it will be unfair. Yes. Sorry? Yes, and Mauritius. Sorry, I forgot. Yes. The island countries, yes. Thank you for the correction. Yes. Now, it would be then be unfair for any of the affected countries to regard itself as only being affected by others. I said so about if there's no control, that is. If one country loses control, then the incidents go high and then they affect the other countries. That's why we work in corridors, in Trans-Limpopo corridors. So I can't see somebody from Mozambique coming to Johannesburg believing that they might be carrying a mosquito. Because then I'm afraid everybody from Hembe, stop them from coming to Johannesburg, because it's endemic there. I'm afraid everybody from Obani to Kanyakunde and Tanzania. So we don't do that. All we are doing is, can you control the vector inside the house? Human beings are not strictly carriers of malaria. And I want to explain why. Scientifically, if you say you are a carrier of a disease, usually, it's when you carry that virus, but it doesn't make you sick. A good example is foot and mouth in agriculture. That virus is carried by buffalo. They are natural carriers. They never get sick from foot and mouth, but they carry it. If that buffalo comes in contact with a cattle or any, what you call, cloven hoofed animal, any animal with a cloven hoof, and cattle are mostly the commonest, but pigs and all that, because their hoofs are cloven. That means, once you get that type of animal, in touch with a buffalo, it gets sick. The buffalo is a carrier. This other animal gets sick. So human beings don't carry malaria. They get sick from malaria. Because nobody can get that Plasmodium virus, the organism that causes malaria, and not get sick. So they are not carriers. They are sick. And you will detect them immediately. I just wanted to make that difference. So our concentration is on the vector. And we have chosen, in most of the African countries, people are forced to sleep under nets. They are given nets. There have only been about 750 million nets distributed around Africa every year. They are given nets to sleep under. Those nets are impregnated with insecticides. We don't use the nets in South Africa because we thought it's unfair. It's very impractical. Maybe I can as well help you to give you the politics of this. Why people are forced to sleep under nets? There's been a call by United Nations environmental program. That DDT, the chemical that we use to control malaria, is what they call a POPs, in environmentalist, a persistent organic pollutant, which stays in the environment for a long time and might cause problems in future. They wanted to ban it. But we made a strong presentation to the World Health Organization that if you ban DDT, you will kill Africa. I'm not sure whether you are aware that here in South Africa, in heeding that call, we did ban DDT in 1996. I'm sure you might remember. Because we're hitting the call from United Nations Environmental Program. What happened? The incidence of malaria increased by more than 600% between 1996 and 2000. Malaria went up by 600%. And we said, we can't ban this thing because we believe DDT might cause problems somewhere in the future. Many African countries went to the World Organization to make a presentation. And the World Organization agreed with us that perhaps the United Nations Environmental Program is just being too over-inficious. We can't ban DDT. But many countries continued using nets because they are funded by donors, and donors threaten them that, no, this DDT you must not use and all that. We find it grossly unfair and politically unacceptable because Europe got rid of malaria. And they use DDT. There's no malaria anywhere in Europe. And the chemical they use is DDT. America got rid of malaria. There's no malaria anywhere in America. The chemical they use is DDT. Now when Africa must do the same, they say, no, this is a persistent pollutant, you can't do so. We found it grossly unfair. When I told them in our arguments, I said, it's like you use a ladder, you go up the roof. When you arrive there, you kick it away. And say nobody else must also go there. We also want to go there because DDT is brutally efficient in controlling mosquitoes. Brutally efficient. And how efficient is it? When you stay a house, the whole house with DDT,
don't believe that the aim is not to kill the mosquitoes. They just don't enter. The DDT just repel them. They don't enter a house where which has been sprayed with DDT. And if a mosquito cannot enter, it means it can't bite a human being. And if it can't, because that's the female. These are the females who are what it's going in, looking for blood in order to lay eggs. If they can't bite human beings, they can't lay eggs. And the cycle dies off and they say, that's how we are controlling. So, but then our question to environmental program was, they must show us one grave of DDT. I'll show them a million graves of malaria of mosquitoes. And that is our position. So the AU took a decision that we must continue using DDT. And that's exactly what we are doing in South Africa. The indoor residual spray, which we are doing in those districts. There's no point in coming to Cape Town to do indoor residual spray. What for? There's no chance in going to Gauteng. We only do it in all those four districts. That's all. And up to so far, we think we have been very successful. And so our target, myself, is the mosquito and where it is, not the individuals who move out of those places. The individuals will check them from their symptoms and treat them immediately. But our question is, can we control the mosquito? If we are able to do so, then we have got the disease under control. Thank you. Can I move to?
Thank you very much, and thank you for the initial presentation. That is what we are seeing. In terms of pregnant women, the risk of mycotoxin pregnancy, but after the patient has been treated, what are the risks, or does the woman remain in the area of the condition? What are the implications of fetal pregnancy?
There are no implications for fetal pregnancy. The woman can't remain a carrier. I've already said that period of viremia is within a short period of 7 days only. So the problem is, won't be a problem. The woman is not in danger. What is in danger is the baby only, not the mother. The mother is just not going to be affected. It's going to be like this Colombian man. She will get fever, joint pain, headache, which will disappear after 7 days. That's the end. The person who will remain with problems, unfortunately, is the baby. And that mother cannot carry that thing forever. It's just for that particular pregnancy during that short window of 7 days or so. Yeah, thank you very much. We are also making this presentation because in February there was a small outbreak of typhoid, and it also sent in fevers all around the country, and I suspected where this whole thing came from. And at least one journalist did confirm on radio when they were asking me. Typhoid fever we get every year. Only that the incidence has increased tremendously over the years with the issue of clean running water and good sanitation. But we do get typhoid every year. Salmonella, the organism called Salmonella typhi, we get it every year. Now, unfortunately, this year, it was reported as if it's new, it's a huge outbreak, etc. Now, when I gave statistics to one journalist about how many cases we got in 2013, how many we got in 2014, how many we got in 2015. She said, how? Can't you have been getting this thing? I said, yes, getting every year. She said, now what? Why is this? No, I'm actually reporting about it. I said, I'm asking you. It's you people who are reporting, not us. Then she said, no, I suspect it has got something to do with this Agoa. You know? Then I realized where the problem is. Because people were confusing things. During the Agoa negotiation, there was a wait about Salmonella. Now people are believing, oh, here it came, even before the first American season arrived. Because it only arrived in March. They were confusing the issues. What were they confusing? Salmonella typhi is the organism here we are talking about, which we get every year. The Salmonella in chicken is not Salmonella typhi, it's a different strains called Salmonella type, Miriam Salmonella inherited this. What you are putting about here is an organism called Salmonella typhi. That causes a disease called typhoid, which many of you might have heard about long ago. It is spread via the oral-fecal contamination. Oral-fecal meaning somebody who has gone to the toilet, whatever they deposited there must find their way into your mouth through contamination, through lack of sanitation, not washing hands, handling food without washing hands, etc. That's what we call the oral-fecal route. The symptoms and incubation periods are 10 to 14 days. They include fever, headache, skin rash, abdominal pains or cramps, nausea, vomiting, constipation or diarrhea. It can be a very serious disease, we accept. Typhoid can be a very serious disease. And we can diagnose it in the blood culture or bone marrow or your stool or your, some of the other tissues. But it can be a very serious disease, even though we are able to treat it. We have, Sub-Saharan Africa has experienced a number of large outbreaks of typhoid over the last decade. That's why I'm saying it's not new. Over the last decade, for instance, there's been, in the beginning of 2011, there's been about 4,000 cases of typhoid fever in Harare. We also had our own extensive outbreaks. Remasala, you remember the famous or notorious outbreak of Demas in 2005, where there were over 500 cases. It had nothing to do with chicken. The sewerage system just leaked into drinking water, and all hell broke loose in Delmas during that time. Many of you who are old enough will remember what happened in Delmas in 2005. So we do get all these sporadic cases. Typhoid fever is endemic in South Africa, I'm repeating. The number of cases and rates deaths have declined over the past 20 years. It's endemic, but over the past 20 years it came down tremendously because our cases in South Africa declined from 6,000 cases in 1985 to only 2,000 by 2002. That means between 1985 and 2002, Salmonella typhi declined by 3,000%, and that's why people believe it's no longer there. It's still there, only that in minute amounts. We are now just in surveillance through the NICD. That's why we are able to catch it. As I said, the risk factor is poor food hygiene, inadequate water and sanitation infrastructure. That's exactly what it brings typhoid into being. The more industrialized cities with low transmission rates, travelers make up a large proportion of the cases. South Africa observes mixed pattern of endemic disease and sporadic cases in more industrialized areas of the country. That's what happened in February. We do have our own, it's an endemic disease, but we also sometimes observe patterns of sporadic cases because of travelers. And this is what happens. If you look at the number of Salmonella type cases by month in South Africa between 2013 and 2016, in that period of 3 years, 2013, 2014, 2015, you see that we mostly have a big jump in January. And it's understandable. Why? In January, people are coming back from traveling. They've been all over Christmas and New Year. They are coming back home. And that's why we say we find 40 cases of travelers. And it's the lowest in June, as you can see. And then, as you can see, there in December, it's not very high. But in December, that's when people are now getting it. And in January, it starts showing itself when they go back home. As you know, the number of cases by province in South Africa, you see how Gauteng is the most affected, followed by Western Cape, then KZN. The rural province is very low. Now, you might ask yourself the question why. Because we said it's an issue of hygiene, hand sanitation, clean running water. How is it supposed to be having more clean running water than Limpopo because it's quite urban? This is because of travelers. What you call it? It's an issue of traveling. As you can see, how it is the most affected. Western Cape is most affected. These are the areas where most travelers go, as you will know. You also know that Mpumalanga with tourism is a little bit higher than all the others, same as KwaZulu-Natal. If you look at Limpopo, Northwest, they are almost invisible there because of the problem of traveling. But some years back when typhoid was still very seriously endemic, when we were getting the 6,000 cases, this graph would have been very different for the rural provinces. Now, the present case, typhoid cases, January to 24 February, that is the one that caused panic. As of 24 February, a total of 33 cases, including 2 deaths, have been reported in 5 provinces. There were 17 outing as expected,
12 in Western Cape, 2 in KZN, and 1 in Limpopo or 1 in Mpumalanga. That's why journalists then panicking and believing that thyroid is spreading. All these cases, or most of them, it was because of traveling. I don't have to repeat that, because we followed up the people that this one traveled here, 9 traveled to Zimbabwe, to Malawi, Bangladesh, India. It's all because of traveling, really. So it was not the new endemic case. Let me use that a little bit of a complex graph, it's not necessary. In Gauteng, as of 24 February, a total of 17 cases have been reported from the city of Johannesburg Metropolitan, which were 10 city of Tshwane, 5 Ekurhuleni, 1 Sedibeng, 1. Among the 14 who travel history of things, 8 travel outside their hometown to neighboring countries. The age of the people affected ranges from 9 months to 49 years. Anyway, I don't think that's very relevant information. I've already told you this is endemic. What else did I tell you? Action taken, revised and disseminated guidelines of diagnosis and management of typhoid fever. Provincial outbreak response teams coordinated, investigated of cases. Rapid and timely follow-up of cases, obtaining of detailed histories from patients and active contact tracing in specimen collection has ensured no further threat of typhoid fever in South Africa. All these people, because they were here, we followed them, followed their contact, took a statement of cases, went to test it, and that's why everything is back to normal now. But we still have to strengthen the active laboratory surveillance system of Salmonella typhi at NICD. That means NICD is still watching very carefully. The two people who died, who caught the panic that now death has already arrived, is because they were reported very late. One of them arrived very late at Charlotte Mackay Academic Hospital and was in very bad shape, and there was no chance of the hospital being able to treat the case. But at the moment, since that time, I'm sure you have heard everything is fine. Thank you very much. But let me finish by saying, the Salmonella we are expecting from AGOA agreement, the one that will be brought by feeding, is not this one. We have not yet noticed it. It's true. It's not necessarily going to come from America, because also our chicken also has got it here in South Africa. It's not that our chicken are free of Salmonella, but it's not Salmonella typhi. Salmonella typhi, strictly orofecal route. Some stools must find their way into our mouth through contamination. Not washing uncooked vegetables, not washing your hands, just eating everything you see at weddings and funerals and all that. That's exactly how you're going to get typhoid. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister, for that presentation. I suppose you should have pointed out that in the case of typhoid, we're dealing with a bacterial infection and not a viral infection, and therefore bacteria, of course, is a key living organism, so it's the way you need to discuss. So thank you for this presentation. I wanted to ask you whether you're happy with the quality of the monitoring when it comes to infection control measures in healthcare settings and in communities. As a first question, I mean, are you happy with our ability to actually stay on top of not only typhoid but all other infectious diseases when it comes to introducing infection control measures in healthcare settings and in communities? And secondly, when it comes to food preparation, what's the monitoring in the employees? Because they're clearly actually health inspectors of food facilities. And I'm not sure whether they're forced on the health or forced on the agriculture, I'm not quite sure. But what are you happy with the level of and quality of monitoring when it comes to food preparation?
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Minister, for the presentation. The question has really led more broadly to the impact on water security and specifically the drought and waterborne disease like typhoid. So of course we know that if we have a decrease in the water volume, we have an increase in concentration of microbials and like those, of course, especially typhoid fever, and of course increased risk to the population. So the question really is, what is the medical in terms of the possible increase in waterborne diseases because of the amount the disease is fighting for, and what then interventions could you put into place to reduce that risk?
I missed that, Dr. Volmi. Sorry. I was distracted. Can you just repeat?
No problem. Just to ask Minister, with the drought and the possible increase in waterborne diseases that raise the risk, what interventions could be put into place to reduce the risk of contamination in that process?
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you,
once again, Minister, thank you for your informative presentation. One of the challenges I think is the issue with regards to the need to look at these things throughout the country.
The issue is what?
With regards to food preparation, with regards to the food that is all on the streets, the unhygienic conditions, the lack of water facilities, fine food products in the bed, open air, aperitifs are being sorted. I don't know what role that, you know, that played actually in the instead of time for itself. But I want to know, in terms of that and what you, obviously the research that you have done, is it related to any particular grouping in the country in terms of those that are very affected? Is it affecting a particular group and particular areas that they are coming from? But finally, I just want to make a fact, since I want to tell it, there's something that bothers me that I want to ask. If you have the minister said to us, different reasons why we get Zika, we get this disease and that disease, so on and so forth, people going after food, we talk about environment. Should we also worry about the fact that what is happening worldwide today, there is this greed and selfishness for power, for control. What does, we have to worry about this in terms of forcefully. And I'm saying this question because today, I'm never convinced as how as I get educated so far. I'm never convinced.
You're not convinced what?
As to how HIV and AIDS affected South Africa, because we were one of the most developed in terms of our health system in all of Africa, but we were mostly affected. Now, the reason why I'm asking this is now, with any diseases coming every 2 years, every 3 years, something is missing. Do you think there's a possibility, and you know, you spoke very clearly about mosquitoes coming after control of human beings, how mosquitoes compare come through their flights and whatever it is. Now, what are the chances that this could also be a deliberate act on part of nations throughout the world to take control, to take power, to destroy certain nations in order to have superpower stations over the world? I just want some clarity on that.
Are you talking about biological warfare or something?
what I see and hear every day, Minister, throughout the world is what's happening. It's not impossible. Remember, in the country, it was initiated.
People go to China without having agreed with us.
Okay.
And that system is very different from
ours.
As I speak now, I've got four teaching pass in China. They can't pass entry exam.
Yeah, I've
had
one that failed three times.
Yes.
Now she needs one reading intensive.
Because Lesotho will have different laws, and I'm sure you're going to work there. The problem is system is different. Lesotho has never had an own system, as you know, because it has been always been a country changing. They've been always been changing. There are people all over the world. Their health professional function is different. Ours here has got different systems altogether. You see, our system is British, very strictly British in health. Our title in health is British. only time when we diverted from the British system, and that's what I'm saying is that now, is when the private hospitals start charging people costly. The reason that healthcare is so expensive, when it comes to money, we've moved to the American system. But when it comes to curriculum, treatment protocols, titles, training, we are fully British. So any other country from the East find it very difficult because they follow a different system.
Okay.
Now, only Russia has realized that. And in fighting with America, they've opened special English or Commonwealth universities to send people from Africa. In special, in other ways, they looked at the British system, copied it and put it in some universities in order to compete. China didn't go that. They are going on with their own system, which is different. So, it's a very difficult issue.
What do you suggest, David? What is the case of
this
school? It's
quite difficult. And maybe you need to explain. And this is, no, man, some of this, I mean, if you state it was deliberately by the bloody senior, and it makes me so angry. He has even done it to say, they sent, I said, you are fasting this kid.
Because when they come back,
yes, what we need to do, he said, no, I thought this speech, what are you discussing with this? Even with the children program, regardless of the fact that I know some people hate it, Dr. Nkosi Dlamini Zuma didn't just close her eyes. She took professors here. They went to Cuba with her. They said there, they examined the curriculum, they discussed. They took people from the health profession council. See that every year, the deputy minister had a delegation of professors and the health professions travel to Cuba to see how we know that their system is primary health care, but to see that it's not miles away from us. Now, other countries, if they are Commonwealth, it's no problem. But this is not a Commonwealth country. They need to give us a chance to go and negotiate and bring professors and see. That's how the Chinese situation is. I don't know how to deal with it because it's a big issue. I've got a parent in Singapore who is crying. Every day phoning me. I don't know what can do because I can't change the rules of the health profession. Where they said if you fail 3 times, over. We give you a chance 3 times only. And thereafter, it's over.
Mm.
So I think that issue of going to the source is a better option. But unfortunately...
No, but these are still 4 years, 4 years.
Their problem is money.
Yes. But they're studying in China. Should they divert? Should they go somewhere else?
If they could, I would really advise them. If they have the possibility of doing that. They are going to struggle on it. I know that my brother also, my younger brother sent the child to China without telling me.
Oh.
And my other brother is a doctor. We all went to him and said, but why didn't you? So we know that when that child comes back, he's going to suffer tremendously.
Is there anything we can do now to divert them either to Cuba or somewhere?
Yes, yes. That's exactly what I was asking. Yeah. We said, that's a brilliant idea. Just give me where are they from?
They bought some cases. I've got all the documents.
Give me the documents. Let's see if maybe for some money, in some way, we can find the diversion. Because my worries keep suffer unnecessarily on this issue.
But don't you think we should then get more publicity with this? Alarming them about going and studying in China and thinking it's not going to help us. See, the problem is the country is not able to take the number of students that want to go and study. That's unfortunately because of course,
look, that number is huge.
Very huge.
That number of people who want to study medicine is huge. The reason that Cuba is able to absorb them, there are 11 million with 27 medical schools. We only have 8. Even if we double our medical schools, we'll still not be able to take them.
What about more schools, Minister? Because they have for students, some of our students are.
Mauritius actually has got an issue with us. They are begging me to keep their doctors. They've got no jobs.
Yes, because there's 400 of them.
Must bring
them. There's 400 of them.
Yes, yes. No, yeah. No, I think that one we can arrange. Okay. Even though if they want to divert to Mauritius, but I've got a plan for the child in Mauritius.
Yes.
Ich würde mal wandern. Oh, kann ich das mal in Brief? Denn ich habe Polnisch nicht so gut. Well, no. Hey, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the English. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I think there were only two questions, if I'm not mistaken, on this issue. The first one, yes, Honorable James just had, yes, that to inform the people because we've been dealing with viruses. That typhoid is a virus, it's not the bacteria, yes. I think that's a very good, sorry, it's a bacteria, not a virus, sorry. It's a bacteria, not a virus. I think it's a very good observation because by and large, viruses have got no treatment, save to treat the symptoms or if you happen to have a vaccine, whereas bacteria are treated largely with antibiotics, except if by some chance they become resistant, as I've talked of antimicrobial resistance. So yes, typhoid is a bacteria, we've always been treating it over the ages and we have not yet encountered the issues of resistance with it. The issue of food preparation. South Africa is out of what we call Codex Alimentarius. This is a special committee formed by the World Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the International Organization of Animal Health. And they've got standards about the way food is prepared. So that saves the world from contamination of whatever type. So we follow the rules of Codex Alimentarius in food preparation all the time. The issue of grout and waterborne disease, yes. Any waterborne disease like typhoid, which depends much on sanitation, if there's grout, there are going to be problems. If there's slug, there are going to be problems. So in this regard, disease like cholera, typhoid, you can always expect them. So we have already started meetings with the Ministry of Water Affairs because of this issue of drought. We know that we are going to have sporadic areas where we have got these problems of typhoid and cholera. But what happens has got nothing to do with the drought. Because as I told you, this was important typhoid. It's people who have gone outside the country and when they come back, then they brought the typhoid. That's right. We're able to control it immediately because these were small groups of people who could identify them and deal with them. The issue of food on the street, Honorable Imam, I think you're right, the issue of carcasses, etc. One of our biggest problems about that is we are still dealing with that, but it's very difficult. In terms of the constitution, when the constitution was adopted in 1996, the issue of environmental care inspectors were given to municipalities. The people used to call health inspectors in the past. Remember, people, the most well-known one was Alfred Nzowi, we even have a bias given to health inspectors after him. Unfortunately, the constitution gave that function to municipalities. Many of the small municipalities found it a big difficult to ever be able to do like that. So the health inspectors, as they were known there, they are now called environmental inspectors, were offloaded from the Department of Health with the belief that municipalities will hire them. I'm sorry to say, unfortunately, many of them did not. And quite a number started looking for jobs elsewhere, in private sector. Some became, unfortunately, CEOs of hospitals, and they could not even cope because that's not what they were trained in. But that whole area became problematic. It's only now That we are trying to really look at it, and we are thinking about finding a way to change and put the bed in the Department of Health. Because my argument is municipalities don't regard health as a major function. Their major function is, can they remove refuse? Well, that is still health, maybe. Can they offer electricity, housing, clean water, sanitation? That's what they do. And they regard the rest belonging to the Department of Health. So this is our biggest weakness. And we are late at Damascus because we don't really have health inspectors anywhere in South Africa, just moving around the streets and, you know, shaking around. That's a serious function we've lost because of constitutional imperatives. In other words, the constitution was assuming that municipalities would immediately be strong enough. And I think it's one of the weaknesses and a wrong assumption. Because only metros can cope, but even many of them, they really don't do this function as much as well as they should be doing, because they don't regard it really as a core function. That part is a serious weakness. The second question was whether it is, I mean, another question related to that was that whether it's related to particular groups. I understand you wanted to say racial groups, but you didn't say so. Yes, I reckon you wanted to say so. Look, it's only that sometimes poverty in South Africa is a proxy for racial grouping. Any disease that largely depends on sanitation will flourish more among the poor, the informal settlement, the poor people, etc., etc. And in our case in South Africa, that obviously will be a proxy for color, but in other countries where they don't have problems of race, it will be a proxy for poverty. It is a socioeconomic disease controlled much by sanitation. People who don't have good sanitation are the ones who largely be affected. And you know which ones are those. But the fact that we reduced by 3,000%, I was asking the professors in NICD, they said, yes, it is to do with the fact that by 1985, sanitation conditions were much worse in South Africa than they are now. They are now advancing. We do have people who don't have sanitation, but quite a large number of them, even in informal settlements, do have. So it is decreasing. The last question, yes, very provocative indeed, about deliberate actions of bringing organisms. That's why I was asking whether it's biological welfare. I think this conspiracy theory has been going on for ages, as you know, all over. Now, organisms were introduced deliberately in our water. I think all over the world, we will have such beliefs. Some of them are myths, others out of fear, some out of suspicions and relationship with other countries, as you say. But if you want my honest opinion, I must tell you, many of them are quite just misplaced. They remain that. Suspicions, fear, innuendo, and maybe just myth. Because there is a wrong assumption that scientists are a homogeneous one group of family people belonging to one particular, should I say, you know, one particular group is sitting in some corner somewhere who can just decide on how to control our lives and the distance. And that's not possible. Among doctors, among scientists, they are just as different and as diverse as ourselves. They've got different political affiliations, different beliefs, different social beliefs. Some are capitalist, others are communist, some are deeply religious, others are atheists. They are not simply one common group of people. So for that reason, the idea of them conspiring to do something to the world without us knowing, are very clean. In other words, I'm trying to say, any scientist who would do this, the others will simply know and catch that. So I'm very skeptical, basically, about the possibility of some of these things happening. And I know, for instance, America is also very suspicious. You are aware that, for instance, since smallpox came to an end in 1970, since the World Organization announced that the world no longer has smallpox, we did not throw that organism away. It is kept in some laboratories, I won't tell you which ones, in some countries. And America is always worried what will happen if that country had used biological warfare. But since 1970, that never happened. We still have the smallpox organism, but it has never been spread anywhere. We do have all these organisms in our laboratories. There's always fear that you'll find the rogue scientist but not all scientists are rogue and they'll control that. For instance, the NICD laboratory in Johannesburg, the one that is being, is in charge of communicable disease, the one that was the only one which was testing Ebola in the whole of SADC, is the only DSL-4. L4 laboratory, as far as we know, in SADC. In Africa, I'm not sure whether there are two. That means biosafety laboratory level 4. There's level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4. And we have the biosafety laboratory here at Fidenham in Johannesburg. What do you mean that it's a biosafety laboratory level 4? It's the highest security laboratory where you can deal with the most dangerous organisms. In the laboratory, you can deal with smallpox, you can deal with anthrax, we can deal with Ebola, all the biggest killers which in the escape were all finished. You do have them in DSL for laboratories, and scientists are working with them and they are working on them, you know. So if we start having suspicions that might deliberately just throw them out into human beings, I'm not really encouraging that type of thinking. Because maybe because I've worked with doctors and scientists and I know they are not as homogeneous and as always agreeing as we think, you know.
Sorry,
the what? Biosafety. Yes, I'm talking about 4. I know 1, 2, 3 are many countries do have, but 4, biosafety level 4, that means the highest level. We are the ones who are heading it. And we keep very dangerous organisms there, and we've got scientists. If you think one day they'll wake up and say, let's kill everybody, they can do so, but that's not a show in centuries, you know. So it will remain a theoretical consideration, as far as I'm concerned. Yes.
But we all know that for sure, that they have enough. But I think what I was asking, is there a possibility, given the fact of all the scientists we have, and interventions in different parts of the world, the problems that are created, the divisions that are created, the hunger for power and control, is it possible? Because remember, even in this country, we had the issue of biological weapons.
Well, it's theoretically possible. Theoretically, yes, it is. Human beings are capable of everything. In the same way that there could be a possibility of biological warfare, but I'm sure you are aware, the United Nations has got conventions about all those things. Conventions and rules about biological warfare, how they control. That's why you are aware about the wars on nuclear, possible nuclear bombs in Iran and all that, where the International Atomic Energy Board goes to check and all that. So there are theoretical possibilities. All our things, quite a large number of them about diseases, they become myths where people, you know, for instance, during apartheid, those myths were around because we never tested each other. Still remember, whenever cholera strikes, you hear stories about the old South African Defense Force. People tell you, yeah, we saw soldiers around the river saying something, you know. And people would believe it because there was mistrust between people in the country and the government and the Defense Force. So all those things among human beings will always remain. For instance, family planning, where I came from, was frowned upon very seriously. Because they said it was a way of government of controlling blacks from becoming a majority. That's true enough. But many people believed it and started running away from family planning. So I'm just saying, wherever the human being, there will be such myths. But some of them remain myths. That there will be scientists who deliberately spread the disease to one part of the world and believing it won't affect them. Never. There was a belief during the apartheid era also, that scientists can produce an organism that kills one race and not the other. Such beliefs were abound. It's impossible for scientists to do so, to produce an organism that will kill one race and lead the other, for the simple reason that human beings are one race. It's only color that separates them. We're one race with the genes and all that. If anybody produces an organism that will kill another race, they also are going to die. So let's also be optimistic that human beings still have humanity in them, and scientists are human beings. I know you are not very confused, but I don't know. Maybe you know something that I don't know. It's possible that you are related, closely related to Nia more than I am. They whispered in your ear about something that is very true, which I don't know. Can I just make an announcement for members of the committee? I don't know whether you have received an invitation or not, but the deputy president and the safety minister will be launching a sex worker program. Is it in Pittsburgh? Oh, in Newtown, in Johannesburg. We have finished our meeting, honorable members, but don't worry. In our continued battle against HIV and AIDS, we still have a big problem among sex workers. We've done our meeting and found that in places like Johannesburg, while the ordinary fever rate in the population is 18%, among sex workers it's 70%. That means 70% of them are HIV positive. Yes, 70. Yes. Now, we regard them as populations that have got relationship with us. Because you know what happens in sex work. And so we thought we need a special program specifically for them. At the moment, our program was only to give them condoms to run away. And they've come to us to complain bitterly that the state is working in a way that we are cutting each other's efforts. The Department of Health issues condoms, the police take them. When the police raid them all over the streets, they take the condoms away. And when we asked them, they said, it is what they want, they must show in court. It's an exhibit in court, yes. It's an exhibit that has been sex work and all that. So I spoke to the commissioner of police, and then, unfortunately, I haven't spoken to the new one, that they need to call all the chiefs of police. We need to sit with them and discuss this issue. Because it doesn't help. And so we are launching that program, which is going to concentrate on exactly what we do for sex workers. A semblance of that was seen in Bangladesh, in India, where we started in 2011, where there's a program funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation called Ibahan. Is it Ibahan or what? Yes. Whereby they've got, on their database, 7,000 sex workers. They know their addresses. They know where they are. They know what they are doing. They know how many condoms they've received. They know all the activities. They treat them, and we found that program in India very attractive because it reduced the prevalence of HIV/AIDS among sex workers. And that's the program we sort of want to launch here in South Africa, that we can't just ignore them. We need to have an intense program with them that will reduce HIV and AIDS, and that's the one that is going to be launched this Friday.
For us as members of the committee to attend those that will be available, especially those that are interested to do something. Something that you want to attend, I think you want
to. Chair, we are just thinking maybe we need to write an official letter to invite the members of the committee who might be available. It's one of the programs that we really must have to get engaged with.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Is this not your friends?
there's one area before the announcement that I think it's important for us to be aware of. We have been joined by two new members. Honorable Koza was introduced in the last meeting. Unfortunately, I think he attended